From the great halls of their house, there are assembled three who hope to one day be the world's greatest driving heroes. Created from the cosmic legends of the universe comes our team captain, the Vision, Bill Fisher, their soon-to-be Wonder Woman, Vicky Fisher, and our Batman, the master of tools, gadgets, and all things mechanical, our mild-mannered, soon-to-be millionaire, Alan Danvers. Their mission? To fight injustice. Share what is right and wrong, to get you out of your house and come out racing with us and serve all mankind. They are the Garage Heroes in Training Team.
Welcome to the Garage Heroes in Training Podcast. I'm going to be one of the hosts for this episode. My name, Bill. Who else is hosting?
I'm Vicky.
And I'm Jen.
You are. Do we have a guest? Do we?
We do. Yes, we have our friend who we had met through Great Lakes, NASA Great Lakes. Run across him several times, and his children.
His whole family. We're trying to get the rest of the family.
We're trying to get the whole family. I'm telling you, Margarita Icy Pops, and I'll have her.
That's right.
I really will. So I'd like to introduce Tim Fokin. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a long time coming. Bill and I have been threatening each other for quite some time about this.
Yeah.
It's been quite a few days, actually. So I think we first met or crossed paths at HBD2. And then you decided, hey, I can't wait all day for this Bill guy. He's way too slow. And you just went right through and just left me, ditched me the whole way. Worked your way through the HPD. You then became an instructor. You race in your Miata. You race in your 944. I think they're both spec cars. Not sure, but we'll figure it out. And then somehow, some way, you did something that made Eric angry. You got the short straw. I'm not quite sure what it was, but you got stuck being my instructor mentor at Mid-Ohio going into my final instructor checkoff for the next time when we're at Audubon. So I want to say thank you for everything you did and apologize for everything that I did this weekend.
Well, Bill, you did make my job rather easy. You had all the answers, which is awesome. If you come to a NASA event like you guys did, with the right attitude, it makes an instructor's job and even a mentor's job super fun. So thanks for doing that, because I enjoyed it. I wish we had more time together, and we will at all.
Yeah, I think you guys are going to be on this journey together. So.
Yeah.
The way I explain it is everybody that you go through HBDE with, you kind of form like this little gang or team, depending on, you know, how you want to look at it. And you're like, it's like when you, I imagine when you serve in the military, you've got your little pack and your little patrol, and you're all one big, you know, you've shared the pain, you've learned together, you've done things well together, and occasionally they trimmed a little grass, whatever, and you just kind of bond over shared experiences. And it's I think about that for a lot of the people in the HPD family.
For sure. Like you said, meeting at in HPD2, where we're not quite figured it out yet, but we've now learned where the gas pedal is. And now we have to figure out how to make the gas pedal do what the rest of the car wants to do. Mm-hmm. Or the other way around, to make the car do what the gas pedal is asking to do. So, that journey is definitely worth talking about in a shared way, because your mistakes are likely the same mistakes that I make, or your mistakes are mistakes that I don't want to make. And so let me learn from your mistakes in a group setting where there's no judgment and no other than a few laughs. where we can collectively gain more than if we were to do it on an individual basis and keep it all internalized and keep it to ourselves. So there's definitely a tribe feeling, like these are my people, you know, and you know, we're not afraid, obviously, to make mistakes in front of each other, and we're happy and glad to help each other along the way.
So, Tim, why don't you give us a little personal brief introduction of yourself?
Sure. I am a commercial airline pilot for a major airline based in Dallas, Texas. I've been flying commercial aircraft for 33 years, and the major portion of that I've spent in the training environment, teaching pilots how to fly. Along the way, I've done a few other things as far as in the aviation sector, but primarily in the training departments at most of the companies I've ever worked at. Recently, was tapped for a chief pilot's position in a major hub. And so that's why I sit in this blank office and get a phone call.
There's no echo whatsoever, Tim. Don't worry about it.
Okay. My new role as of June is chief pilot. I've yet to decorate my office because I spend a lot of time outside of it and spend a lot of time interacting with the pilot group and leading and versus directing from an office chair.
Mm-hmm. So you also have children who are racing with you also.
I've got five wonderful children, two of which are my middle, well, I guess it's not my middle boys, my second oldest, and I have a set of twins, and it's the older of the two twins. They come to the track with me and have been coming to the track with me since we started, and they are now both drivers. Reese is in HBDE3 at NASA Great Lakes and developing into a really fast and confident race car driver that worries me because I'm only 3 seconds faster than him.
Yeah.
And now his brother Skyler, who has been dragged along at the track, has gotten permission to start to drive. And so he did a hyperdrive event with NASA Great Lakes at Autobahn, where he stuck his toe in the water and totally convinced himself he is born to do this.
To endurance racing, he's ready.
Yeah, right. He is crewed on every endurance race I've been through. And, you know, the vocabulary is there. Understanding of the flags is there, and now we're going to get him the driving piece. And so, you know, now the real work begins, you know, for him.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's great to go out with your kids and do this kind of stuff. I highly encourage it. If anybody's thinking about a father daughter or father son activity, do it because it will bring to you and your children a bond that is an amazing gift.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
So let me interrupt the podcast. I just got a text message from your student this weekend, and he said that all the insights and advice worked out, and his last session was by far his best, and wanted to thank me and you. I told him if he put a sticker on his car, it would go much faster. He said the stickers worked. So
garage. He said he put two. Yep. He put two. I can verify it. I saw one on the back and on the driver's side, one on the driver's side of the passenger car, the passenger side of the car. And so, yeah, I think that's worth at least 2 or 3 miles an hour.
Oh, well, easily.
Two stickers twice as fast.
That's right. Go fast stickers.
Well, so, you know, Adam did a great job. I talked about earlier coming to the track with the right attitude. Adam came with the right attitude.
Oh, for sure. He's a good guy. I think he enjoyed it. That's the most important thing.
And the weather cleared up for the last session, and it all clicked. The light bulb went off, and we had a great last ride around the track for the last 20, 25 minutes. It was fun. It was rewarding to watch.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
So Tim, why don't you share with us, how did you get the racing bug?
So, I was looking for another hobby. My hobbies have always been, on the high adventure side. And, the last transition I made, prior to motorsports was, I'd been a duck hunter for a long time, and my duck hunting partners, unfortunately, his wife got ill. And so, we couldn't travel then duck hunt anymore. And so, you know, I was faced with, golfing, which is probably cheaper, but far more frustrating than motorsports and, or something else. And I literally, I saw a NASA Great Lakes like promo video on YouTube, and I don't know how or why, but it showed up in my kind of, you need to watch this thing. And I was sitting at home. It was literally the beginning of November. And I called the number, and I actually talked to Jay Andrew, and he took like an hour to talk to me because I had a million questions. And he told me, yeah, you know, if you're really into it, try this out. You know, you can find yourself a good car. And he suggested a Miata. About 3 weeks later, I was on my way to South Carolina to buy my first Miata with a trailer in tow and absolutely no idea what I was looking at. And so about 5 minutes out from the place I was about to buy this car from, I called Jay again. And he graciously took the call and walked me through the process and told me what to look for. that car has been amazing. That was the best equipment purchase I could have ever made. The Miata is truly a great tool to learn on. Momentum race cars, momentum cars, teach you how to drive a slow car fast. And if you can drive a slow car fast, I think we all know that you can drive any car fast after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
You know, we just had a conversation, me and another Miata friend, about it. And the thing about Miata is that it teaches you how to take advantage of certain parts on the track to get
absolutely
ahead of other vehicles,
because you are slower,
right?
Yeah.
And it definitely it's not so much as fast on the straightaway as it is in the turns. You can really gain a lot of speed in the turns. You can really do a lot of stuff, and then after that is car craft, you know,
right,
to get absolutely what you need to do. Yeah,
yeah. The Miata offers a lot of things. Speed isn't one of them, right? Or, you know, lightning speed,
right.
But what it does offer is the opportunity to take it to the limit, probably with the most education. Like, you have to learn to do that. That's not something where, like, you come to the track with a high horsepower car with all the nannies, buzzers and whistles, and you immediately look like, you know, an F1 driver because you're fast and the nannies are taking care of you. An NA Miata or an NB Miata doesn't have those buzzers and whistles. And so in order to get to the spot where you're going to feel like you're really doing something other than driving around the track in a clumsy and awkward way, you really have to learn racecraft. You really have to learn car control. You really have to understand vehicle dynamics. You really have to work at getting good. But when you get there, it's so rewarding because you've taken this very slow tool and made it a piece of grease lightning. And that's when you go, yeah, this is fun, you know?
Absolutely. I love it. So going forward, I mean, with regards to racing, what is on your bucket list with it? Where are you going to take this?
So I'm going to take it as long as far as I can go. grassroots racing is super fun. I really enjoy it. And I don't see myself going, you know, outside of, you know, any kind of grassroots, circuits. We're talking, a few of us are talking about putting together a, endurance car and team, and maybe doing a couple of the other circuits, and putting together a serious effort. But, you know, of course, never in the, in a professional sense, but always in a buddy racing sense. So while we're serious and competitive, the focus is going to be on fun. And so, you know, we're all type A, but we all are type A with a, you know, with a smile, if that makes sense. The focus is going to be fun. And, so some more endurance racing, maybe a series different, here or there, but, certainly the focus for me is endurance racing. I really enjoy that. And it, the way, not just NASA Great Lakes, but the way it seems, around, the different organizations is that, you can endurance race, and then take the rest of the weekend off, you know, if you endurance race on a Friday, you can take Saturday and Sunday and really enjoy the track, in a way different way than if you're, you know, a sprint racer, three races a day, Saturday and Sunday, maybe Friday, Saturday and Sunday, really fills up your weekend. So again, I think the focus for me, personally is that I think my kids will pick their own, path. Reese is probably leaning towards wheel to wheel racing. And Skylar, I think is, still a little too early to decide. So, we'll see, but I'm ready for the ride wherever it takes me. I'm ready to go. And of course, I'm going to absolutely unequivocally continue instructing. It is super rewarding. It is, it comes super natural for me because of my aviation instructing background. And so it, while some people have to learn how to be instructors, I've been an instructor for a long time. And so whether you instruct in an airplane or a car, it's kind of the same. I will say this, we have a mutual, I guess, associate or friend or however you want it, Ross Bentley, and I exchanged some emails before I went and became an instructor. And I told him, I said, you know, my number one fear is that to get in the right seat of a car without any controls, in front of me in an airplane as an instructor, you have a full set of controls, in front of you. And if things go horribly wrong, you know, the instructor pilot steps in and says, I've got it, save the day. And we, you know, we'll debrief it on the ground. In a car, things start to go horribly wrong. There aren't a whole lot of options, at your disposal other than to be in front of the car to avoid that you know, as early as possible. So, I was glad that I was able to, at my first try at it, be as relaxed as I was, because that was a serious, point of anxiety and trepidation for me. And, you know, easily overcome by that first experience.
So you and your kids all have tasted racing and like it. What do you, when you're working on cars or, working together, does everybody have a certain role, or do you, kind of share the responsibilities? I mean, do you like do most of the mechanical stuff, or are you just driving? Like,
so in the beginning, I did everything because they really didn't know how to do everything. Mm-hmm. And so as we've grown together, and as time has passed, they've taken on more responsibility and, been able to, share some of the load, which is really nice. I can ask them to load the truck with, all of our gear, and with, you know, a reasonably high degree of certainty, feel like I can show up the, you know, the night that we're supposed to go, get in the truck and drive and open the truck the next morning and have what we need. And that's taking time. That's not something that happened on the first time out. but that's something we developed. Same thing, you know, brakes. They can do brakes. They can change oil. They can, you know, diagnose small problems. They can, you know, tighten up nuts and bolts. You know, after a race, you do a nut and bolt check. You know, they're taking more of an active role in the maintenance side of it now and the preparation side, as they get more mature and understand the implications of ignoring that.
So do you, when you're instructing, especially in racing, I'm always very curious, do you have a particular philosophy when you're instructing?
I do. I have a very unique philosophy. And it goes across, the similarities between aviation and motorsports are numerous, and you wouldn't believe the ease that you can move between both, because they are so similar, the preparation and the anxiety factors, right? That they're all there, right? They're no matter if you're in an airplane or in a race car or an HPDE car, the same level of anxiety occurs as for a student, whether, again, you're in an airplane or a car. And so the philosophy that I operate under and always have operated under as an instructor is my role as an instructor is to build up the student, not beat up the student. Learning is never, ever going to take place. If you're a curmudgeon, or if you yell, or if you get loud, or if you get upset, those, you know, none of those things are conducive to having your student relax. And your student will never learn until they become relaxed, until they get comfortable in that uncomfortable situation. And so as an instructor, my singular goal at the outset of meeting my student, whether it's on a phone call or an email, is to lower that anxiety level and help them understand that the reason we're going to do this is the fun factor at the end. It's not always easy, right? If it were easy, everybody would come out and do it. It takes some hard work and it takes some preparation on their part. And if you're honest and upfront with them from the beginning as to what they're going to have to do, they're usually pretty motivated to do it. Let's face it. They plunked down a little bit of money to get this done. And if they're showing up, they're motivated.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, not that money is the motivator for everybody, but they're at least interested in trying this out. And they want to hear from the instructor what the best way to go about this is. And so if you can offer ways to lower anxiety and increase the comfortability, then the learning occurs much faster. So again, my philosophy is to build them up, not beat them up, and to welcome them into the community and help them understand that everybody there is pulling for them and for them to succeed. All the instructors, not just myself, everybody that's there, it wants them to go out and have a great time.
Well, I mean, you did go the extra mile this weekend with him by teaching him how to cut the grass as well as you have in the past. So.
Ouch.
Well, you know, I've said it from the beginning, Bill, if you spin and wreck enough times, you get recognition.
Yep.
But up.
And you have opened your own lawn service on the side, so it's greatly appreciated. Yeah. So. Well,
my boys are inheriting the family business as we speak.
Yeah, there you go.
That's awesome. So with the, I was wondering, you know, when you're a pilot and you're a race car driver, there's obviously some similarities, but maybe there's some differences as well in the driving and the training. And we started talking about it. So maybe we get into that a little bit. And do you think that that being a pilot that helped you with racing?
It certainly did. The organizational skills required to fly an airplane, you can imagine, are enormous, right? The complexity, the science, the act, right, is all a huge undertaking. Not much different than motorsports, right? The act of driving the car, it can be, and if you saw me on Friday in 100 degree weather, right, the act of driving the car was pretty physical this week. Not so much in an airplane. There's air conditioning, you know, and the bigger the airplane, the more comfortable it is. There's no question about it. But the organizational skills are similar, if not identical. The motivation is also key, right? You can't just decide that, you know, in a very nonchalant way, you're going to go learn how to fly an airplane. And the same is true for most people about motorsports. If you're going to do this pretty seriously, then you have to approach it in a pretty serious way. That means reading. That means studying. Dare I say that, the S word, right? That means, you know, really immersing yourself in motorsports culture. Because when you do that, you learn really fast, and you become what you really aspire to be, whether it's an HPDE driver or a race car driver or whatever it is, right? So if you can take that time, and many people do, take that time to get really serious about this, then you know, we'll see you at the next event. You mentioned earlier the group of folks that we started out in HPD with. You know, those are the people that I'm talking about. Those are the people that have been studying, reading, talking to other people about joining Facebook groups or forums, really taking the hobby serious, right? And becoming really, really good at it. So, you know, the similarities again are, you know, the ability to compartmentalize, right? That's a really good example. In an airplane, when you make a mistake, you can't dwell on it, right? In a car, and if you make a mistake, you can't dwell on it because you're hurtling down the track at 130 plus miles an hour, maybe, if you're not in a Miata, right? but you're moving down the track pretty fast, and the next corner is coming up. So you can't really think about the mistake you just made. Same in an airplane, right? You're moving through the air at a high rate of speed. And if there's a mistake that's made, you really don't have time to think about it. The time to think about it is after you've landed or after you stop, come off the racetrack and analyze and learn, right? Nobody, and this is another part of this philosophy, right? Nobody has ever driven the perfect lap. Nobody has ever flown the perfect flight. And so if you go into it acknowledging that you're going to make mistakes and that you're going to learn from those mistakes, then you're probably 5 feet in front of all your competition. And so I hate to sound like Yoda, but you know, that's really the trait that makes a great driver, is if they can compartmentalize, if they can put that error behind them and go to the next corner and forget about it until they come back around the track to that same spot and don't make that error. You know, I'm not going to do that again. I'll put the car in a different spot this time. And, you know, that's the mark of somebody that's continuously learning and evolving.
One thing that I'm also learning is to not obsess about it when you're on the track.
Yeah, you can't.
I mean, just that one area. Don't constantly think about it as you're going around, like, oh, I got to do that one better. No, do it in the moment, but don't.
Right. Do it in the moment. And, you know, keep it in the back of your mind that, hey, you know, turn one's coming up. I really botched that turn. I'm not going to do that again. Let me try this a little differently this time. I know where I need the car. Now let me try and get it there, you know? And you know, if that means taking a mile an hour or two off your speed so you can figure out the line, then so be it. Right. But you know, that's what this is about, is learning, is feeling the car dance around the track, in the most graceful way you can make it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like. I like really taking my car out and feeling like it's a dance partner, and that now it's time for us to go around the entire ballroom and show everybody how graceful we are, or not, and I'll cut the grass. I mean, that's how I think about it. That's my theory. You know, that's the place I go to when I get in the car.
So since Joey's too shy to come on the podcast, what's your favorite Joey near death pilot story that you've seen or heard?
All right. So, do your listeners know who Joey is?
Well, we've been trying to get him on. Joey Pollock is the HB2, one of the three lead instructors, and I'm guilting him into coming on the podcast by now. I'm just decided anybody who knows him, I'm going to talk about him. So,
right. So Joey Pollock is a fantastic instructor and great HBD2 group leader, along with Derek and John. All three of those guys are really responsible for my growth as an HBD driver, especially going from two to three. They were instrumental in helping me through. So shout out to all three of them. Joey Pollock also is a former Navy aviator and I think an intruder driver, right? An A6 guy. And that's a fighter bomber and close air support airplane. I think, Joey, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you will. And I love you for it. My favorite Joey Pollock story is his, dive bombing training with a relatively new student, and the student goes into what we call G-lock or in racing, red mist, right? They become completely fixated with the task and lose absolute situational awareness. In other words, they don't know where they are in time or space. They just are so focused on the mission, which is, in this case, dropping the bomb. And so Joey's in this giant dive, and you know, they get to the bomb drop altitude, and the student fails to pickle the bomb. And Joey says, "What are you doing?" And there's no response. And Joey says to the student, "What are you doing?" No response. And finally, Joey has to take control of the jet. However, the student has full control because he's muscling the airplane to the point where Joey can't get him to undo it. So Joey has to distract the student. And the only way he can think of is one, to hit him, or two, place his hands in front of his eyes, Joey's hands in front of the student's eyes. And Joey does that and breaks the student's concentration. And they realize that they're, you know, mere seconds away from death. And they Joey saves the day. Yay, Joey, right? Mm-hmm. That's my favorite Joey Pollock story. That's germane to motorsports because as HBDE students, especially early on, tend to get locked up on the brake lights in front of you, right? You're following the vehicle in front of you to the point where if that vehicle goes off the track, you'll follow that vehicle right off the track because they're so fixated on following that car that all they're really looking at is either the license plate light or the tail lights or the bumper. And they're not really looking at the big picture in front of them, the racetrack or the other cars that are affecting what's going on. And so it's a good example of what can happen and a great example of how an instructor can break that chain of events. That's my favorite Joey Pollock story.
That's awesome.
Joey, come on the podcast. It doesn't hurt. Oh
my God, he's so shy.
It hurts a little bit.
That's right.
I'll let you know later.
Yeah. So I believe, and I could be wrong, you know, I've been wrong before. If you need the whole list, Vicky's got it bound in leather.
And he'll never admit it though.
On our second volume. And you know, just in case you know. But I believe that part of your aviation background and part of your training has led to you, whether you are adopting it because you like it or adopting it because it's forced upon you, the adoption of checklists. And I believe that in racing, especially, checklists are pretty much critical
doing anything. Checklists are critical in aviation. We use them every day. But checklists with a read and do kind of a checklist are real old school. Mm-hmm. So what we've developed, and it's through best practices and years of read and do checklist. In other words, the battery switch gets turned on and everybody responds on, right? That's a read and do. Rather than a read and do checklist, we now use what's called triggers and flows. And the concept of a trigger and flow is that a trigger is an event or a place in time, right? A specific time where you do something and you do the flow, which is a predetermined set of events, okay, or set of items. And you do it the same every time at the same time or the same trigger point. So, for instance, 3 days out from any event that I'm going to attend, my car goes on the trailer.
Right.
The trigger is the 3 days, and the flow is I put the car on the trailer. Okay. So that's a simplistic way of looking at it, right? But what I'm saying is that while read and do checklists work, the concept of read and do checklists is passé now. It's old. And so the new and improved way of thinking is that there's going to be a pattern, and I'm going to follow the same pattern every time. And what's going to make me follow that pattern is an event, whether it's a place in time or a specific occurrence. Okay. Places in time work really good for race preparation. Events work really great for at the track. In other words, I'm 30 minutes from being on grid. I need to make sure that I checked these things: tire pressure, lug nut torque, fuel, and equipment. That's my 30 minute trigger and flow. That's my checklist, if you will. So checklists are great, but triggers and flows are better.
So how would one go about developing a trigger and flow for a, you know, let's be selfish and say an endurance race?
So I mean, I actually use that, right? So my trigger is I register for an event. At that point, right, I've got to go to my car and make sure that my car has a nut and bolt check. That's no less than 10 days out. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I register, I go out and I do the nut and bolt check, get underneath the car, put it up on jack stands, put it on a car lift, whatever your method is to do a nut and bolt check. It's time to do that. Mm-hmm. So no matter what it is that you want to do, and this works in everyday life, right? I mean, 7 a.m., my alarm goes off, I get in the shower, and I get ready to go to work. Mm-hmm. That's a trigger and a flow.
Right.
So everybody's already doing it. Now you just have to adapt it to your situation. Right. So for another example for endurance racing is, say the race is at 2 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
At 12 o'clock, 2 hours before I'm supposed to be on grid with my race car and ready to go for this 5 hour or 4 hour or 7 hour or 12 hour event, I had better make sure that my pit box is ready to go. Right. And in what's in the pit box, all my tools, my table, my fire extinguisher, my speedy dry, my spare parts, my jack, my fuel, my comm system tested, ready to go. Mm-hmm. All of those things. Again, now you see how, I mean, I don't need to read that because I live it, right? And I do it the same every time. Now, some people feel like they need to remind themselves with a checklist, right? And there's no shame in that, right? There's no, if you need to write it down, by all means, write a checklist down, you know, write something. Don't forget to bring the fire extinguisher, you know, or while you're loading the truck, make sure all your safety equipment is in there, right? Everything, your Hans, your helmet, you know, your gloves, your fire suit, your socks, your underwear, your shoes, all of your safety equipment, you know, grouping things together makes it easier. Right. And that's how I do it. Do I have a written checklist? No.
Do you need one? I got lots.
What's that?
Do you need some? I got lots of them.
Yeah.
You know what? I probably...
Endurance racing is just a different beast. You just it need is. To roll with a garage. You really do.
You do. You know, so right. Exactly. Right. Do I have every flipping part that I could possibly break? And the answer is, I think so. But the answer is always no. Right.
Well, with the cars you drive, you need to bring Friday's, that 944 part.
Right. Yeah. Friday's endurance race. Here we go with a 944 lap two or three. My driving partner. Shout out Shane Denny, woo, number 57 at NASA Great Lakes. my driving partner radios, I'm coming in. And I'm like, for what? This is lap three, dude. We're not scheduled for another, you know, 50 minutes.
Wow.
And he goes, I got a power issue. So I'm like, okay. So he pulls in. I'm like, what's wrong? He goes, I think the throttle cable broke. So, of course, we pop the hood, and it's not a throttle cable. It's the cam. It's the throttle cam. Mm-hmm. The nut on the top of the throttle cam came loose. Couldn't find it. And so, you know, what do? I jump in my truck and drive up to my paddock, get the throttle cam off my race car and, you know, and a wrench and bring it down, hand it out the window. And, you know, we put it back on the car and off we are. You know, but that's not a part that I would generally think that you were going to need, you know, so, you know, when you're endurance racing, the parts car in the trailer is key.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
I'm going to self-profess. I'm a fan. Okay. I think when you were talking with, one of your guests about running Thunder Hill, that's exactly what he said is, you don't bring just your car. You bring your car and a parts car in the trailer.
Yep.
Yeah, I've heard that. If you're going to be doing that big racing, yeah, you might as well just bring a donor car.
Right.
It's actually pretty smart.
It's very smart because you don't know if you're going to need a hood or door or some glass. Right?
Mm-hmm. So you were just talking about why do you choose a 944?
Because when I was a teenager, I wanted one badly and I couldn't afford it, and so the cool factor for me is super high. Mm-hmm. but that was my driving motivation. I really loved the car from a very young age.
You know what it takes to replace the clutch, right?
That too.
there's a reason why we don't do Porsches.
Wait a minute.
There's a saying in aviation. There's many sayings in aviation, but it really translates well to racing. Because the answer is identical, right? How do you make an airplane fly? And the answer to that question is money and paperwork. Mm-hmm. Right. How do you make a race car drive? Money. It's like a boat, right? It takes the every dime you have.
Yes, no spares.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. No spares, right. There. Or you go with no spares and pray, right?
Right.
Yeah, that doesn't work for us.
That never works for me. I'm usually the guy loading up on, 3 hours into the event, going, I didn't think I needed that. And that was a big part of the learning curve the first year doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Was what exactly do I need to bring? Because I can't bring everything. I can't really load the garage onto my trailer. So you have to learn what's critical, what you may be able to borrow from your fellow racers at the track. And that goes back to that community, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole reason behind spec racing and spec classes is everybody has the same parts. So if you show up with a one-off race car and you have an issue, very likely you're done. But if you show up in a spec class car and there's 25 in the field, you might be able to scrounge a few extra parts up between the 25 guys or girls that are out there racing with you.
Yeah.
So are you racing or would you race in a spec series?
I would race in a spec series.
I know a guy who's also racing in a spec series.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's what I said earlier, Vicky, is I'm open to any kind of racing or any kind of high performance driving activities. I'm not really sure where it all is going to wind up, but I enjoy it so much that I'm open, willing, and able to take advantage of any of the opportunities that may present themselves.
So speaking of an opportunity, there's this thing that I'm not sure that all of our listeners are aware of, that I have been trying to talk my two friends that are hosting with me into doing. And I believe I may have started tilting it towards a yes answer on Friday when I was there watching you and walked away when your car was broken, because we all know how valuable I am for mechanically fixing things. But there's this thing on Fridays that I've been trying to do for 2 years now, and we're going to do it next year, whether it's with these two or not. What is a Trek event, Tim?
So a Trek event is a team race endurance challenge. And it is a extended sprint race. So it's not really, it's an endurance event, but they're at NASA Great Lakes, they're not more than 7 hours for now. I'm not really sure what the...
How many hours? 7 hours?
Seven. That's the longest one we've run so far. It's an endurance race, but it's not like an endurance race in the sense of, a 24 hours Thunderhill or something like that. Right. It's or a lemons race, a 24 hours of lemons. It's a one and done kind of a day. So start at noon and finish up at 7 p.m. Most of the events are less than that. We start out really slow at NASA Great Lakes this year. We started out with a 2 hour event, then we built up to a 4 hour, then we went to a five, and then at Pitt we did a seven, and we just did a 4 hour race this week on Friday. They're longer than a sprint race, but not so long that you can't participate, even if you're a single driver. And that's the beauty of it. It's a really good way to introduce yourself or a team to the concept of endurance racing without having to go full tilt, bring your spare car and go to Thunderhill and run 24 hours, which is not a good place to start. Right?
No, not on the fly.
Right, right. So it's one of those series that is brand new to our region, not to NASA, but to our region. And it's a fledgling series. It started, I believe, last year. And, you know, this year it's been growing and growing. I think this last race was the largest car count, largest field. And it was great. It was really good. Super, super competitive. Lots of strategies involved. It's not just go out and put laps down. It's go out, put laps down for a purpose. And it's neat. I ran the pit endurance race with our good friend Eric Meyer, and we podiumed in third. And so for a novice effort, that's pretty good.
So just a few questions on Trek. So do your cars need to be caged?
They do. NASA Great Lakes region has a supplemental rule section, and the car does need to be a prepped race car.
Nice. I like. Mm-hmm. And let me see what else. Safety gear, I imagine, goes along the same lines as a regular endurance. So you have to have fire suppression. You have to have all of that.
Yep. Fire suppression in the car, whether it's a fire suppression system or a fire extinguisher. So the car that you run has to be teched as a race car. So you need a race annual, you need a logbook, you need a cage, you need to meet the all the criteria that make a race car. You have to meet all of that criteria for Great Lakes Trek races.
Kill switches also?
Yep. Full race annual. And so all of those things are in the club rules and conditions.
So people that come to do the Enduro Light is what, you know.
Trek race.
Right.
Trek race.
Yeah.
Who are the people that, or the types of people that show up for that? Are they regular endurance racers, or are they sprint racers that are maybe crossing over?
It's all the usual maniacs. Right. This year I've seen everybody from just about every class out there. We've got guys running Thunder Roadsters. We've got Spec Miatas, E46s, one-offs, just about the entire the Honda Challenge guys, just about the entire field of race classes can race in the Spec Challenge or in the Spec series. I'm sorry, in the Trek series. There's about four or five different race groups, and it's T1, T2, T3, T4, you know, that kind of thing, TU, and so. It's really classed according to your car, and it's competitive inside your class as well as for the entire field. You can win the entire race as well as your class, or you can win just your class. Or win within your class, I should say. So there's lots of different facets to it, and clearly it's appealing to all kinds of different drivers. Across all kinds of series within the Great Lakes region. And it's super exciting. I really enjoy it. I don't know if you can tell.
So do you guys share a car or do you run multiple cars?
So you can do both. There are what they call relay teams where you can share a similarly prepped car. So if you have a Spec 944, a Spec Miata, and you have two of those, you're not restricted to run just one car. You can run both cars, but you have to share a transponder. And under Great Lakes rules, you have to share a car number. So there are some restrictions that relay teams use or have to adhere to. And they're not onerous. They actually make it kind of easy so that, even though it's kind of counterintuitive to an endurance type of or enduro type of racing, everybody can come out and compete.
So do you, you have listened to our podcast a few times in the past.
More than 10 times, Bill.
That's fine. Again, race drivers don't make great decisions. But anyway, so traditional good, bad, and the ugly. Let's do things you've done or things you would do that you would recommend, things that you've done that you would not recommend. And ugly is always story time. But let's look at it from your racing, trek racing, maybe, side of the world. What are your good, bad, the ugly?
So the good is deciding to do it and mm-hmm. and doing it early as I possibly could. I felt like it was a good way to see if I really had what it took. If I was really while in HPDE3, if I was really going around the track with all the right parts and pieces, and I really had the situational awareness required to get into a race, that's the good. And the answer was Great Lakes, and this is a plug, Great Lakes HPDE system preps you well for this kind of racing, among other things. But by the time you get to that level in NASA Great Lakes, you're well prepared. And I don't mean the day you show up at HPDE3, but maybe after two or three events, you're a 3.5, not just a 4 or just an early 3, but like a 3.5. You've got some HPDE3 events under your belt. You're comfortable with side-by-side driving, passing in the corners, all the stuff that HPDE3 at NASA Great Lakes really preaches and teaches you. When you're comfortable there, it's time, if you're wanting to, you're well prepared to make that leap, and be really comfortable. Surprisingly comfortable for me. Talk about anxiety, right? I'm an instructor. My job is to lower anxiety. Boy, I'll tell you what, that first time I was going to trek race, I put on my fire suit. I got in the car. I put on my belts and I had to get out of the car because I was going to hyperventilate. I was so anxious.
Right? Had that a few times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
you're not the first one to tell us that.
Yeah. I mean, I was so nervous. I almost puked. Right? So I gathered my thoughts. I talked to myself like an adult, put yourself together, man, kind of thing. And I went out there, dug my spurs in, and ran my 944 around the track. And it was probably one of the greatest things that I could have done in motorsports for myself. Because it really added a level of confidence that I needed. I hadn't done it. I wasn't familiar. I wasn't sure. I knew I thought I had the right training, but I wasn't convinced that I had all the pieces figured out yet. And I still don't have all the pieces figured out. Newsflash. I learn something every time I go to the track. And that's the thing I really enjoy.
It's stitching together all those 20 minute lessons and sessions,
right?
Because there's a lot that goes on the track besides just going fast.
There is,
and
right?
And get the learning out of your head and actually apply it for an extended period of time. And that's when you really start pulling it all together and realizing that, you know, it's not just the endurance part is the focus level.
Right. You're absolutely.
And when you're going for 2 hours, it's a lot of spatial awareness at that point, and it's a lot of focus, and it's a little bit of a beating up on your body, and it's your hydration, and and you know, you get into like, sometimes you get into little tangles, you know, yeah. which sometimes you do. You have to be ready for that also. And it's hard to learn all that in 20 minutes.
It is. Each shot. And it also, the Trek, the secret to Trek racing is self-control, right? Secret to you know, sprint racing is listen, I've got 20 minutes. I've got to go out and give it my all.
Right. Like
from minute
endurance,
one
you can't do that.
Number 20, right. And endurance, you have to really pace yourself. And if you don't reel yourself in, that red mist that we talked about earlier can really take over in the first lap as you're going down the front straight when they throw the start flag. I mean, the first green flag, everybody's got their brakes locked up, you know, four wide into turn one. And, you know, that's, you don't want to be that guy. You know, or that girl. You know,
The other thing too is you got to really get a good read on your car because it's endurance. You got to make that puppy keep going. So if you feel like your car is, there's something going on, you got to pull that sucker in. You got to check it out.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Unless you have unlimited money, funds, and time, right? Because it's a long push from the hot pits to the paddock.
Right. Yeah. So no, it's true. There's a lot that goes on. You learn a lot just endurance racing. And I think that's what we like so much about the Great Lakes is that Great Lakes, after we go to the Great Lakes, we go back onto the track and we've improved again.
Right.
And it's a consistent and it's pulling it all together. And honestly, it's the only series, group that we go to that actually gives us that return versus you know, when we go out to other areas, we go out there for a different purpose. They don't have as much class time, but they have more seat time, but it serves its own purpose. But if I want education, I'll travel 6 hours, I'll travel 8 hours to go get that.
Right. And you know, it's funny you say that because I instruct for another group that is more of a lapping organization, and that has its place, right?
Mm-hmm.
That absolutely has its place. But, you know, if you don't get that education piece first, you're just going to go out and turn laps and practice bad habits. And so you're practicing lap after lap after lap of the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no improvement other than maybe some self-assessment where you go, you know, I really think I can get faster, but I don't know how I can do that because I'm not really don't have a coach or an instructor to help me understand why or how. So I mean, that education piece is huge.
Yeah.
Shout out to Robin.
Robin.
Right?
Pew, 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 around, man.
That's exactly what I was just about to say is, you know, go around the track. And especially a new track and try and figure out where all the flag stations are. Use Robin's trick. Pew, pew, pew. I've seen bumper stickers, shirts, toolboxes, you name it with that pew, pew, pew sticker. And let me tell you, it works. It works. You know, and same thing with, you know, you talk about HPDE, right? From the very first time I drove on Mid-Ohio with one of my first HPDE1 instructors, Ted Kessel.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up into Thunder Valley, I was having trouble with getting the car in the right place on the track. And there's a dirt patch where all the racers go over the yellow curbing, right? And I can remember Ted telling me, put this car in that dirt so that you have to wash it when you're done. Well, guess what? On Friday, I'm driving in the endurance race. And who do I hear in my voice as I come up that hill? Ted Kessel. Put this car in the dirt.
That's right.
All right. So we all agree there's good stuff. Is there any bad from the track that you've seen or stuff that you said, shouldn't do that again?
Story time.
No. You know, You can point out a million things. I mean, if I was perfect, you probably wouldn't want to talk to me because I'd be boring.
Definitely wouldn't be on this podcast.
Right. You know, jumped in the car for test and tune, and didn't check the tire pressures.
Oops.
And went around the first turn at Mid-Ohio, actually turn 3, right, the keyhole, and got so loose that I thought, my goodness, what have I bitten myself? You know, what have I bitten off here? Yeah. And then did the same thing in Thunder Valley, coming over the hill in Thunder Valley. And so when I came off the track after the test and tune, I went to my driving partner and said, hey, man, you know, I know this is a 944, but what's so different because your car is so much looser than my car? And he said, oh, you know, just, I guess it's just the wheels, or, you know, just back it down a notch. Don't go out and do that, you know. Well, sure, I'm, you know, I definitely don't want to go out, get loose, get off the track, or, you know, bend some metal. That's the bad part. Good part is that we realized that neither one of us checked the tire pressures, and we had in the rear 20 pounds on the left side, 30 pounds on the right side.
that's nice.
That was pretty significant, right? So yeah, don't want to do that again, right? Add that to the checklist, to the trigger and flow portion of the program. Check the tire pressure, Tim, right?
Does help. Mm-hmm. You got an ugly yet, Tim, or TBD?
Oh, yeah, several uglies. I've got HPD Student of the Year award because I did it so ugly. early in my HPDE driving career, I was having a lot of trouble with car control. Getting up to the limit was something that was terrifying to me. And here's why. Okay. As a commercial airline pilot, you spend your entire career and your daily focus is to be as far away from the limit as possible. Right. You don't ever want to operate on the limit as an airline pilot. You always want to operate in the safest, most, you know, fattest safety margin you can build for yourself. This is a monster difference in between aviation and motorsports, right? In motorsports, the closer you are to the limit all the time, the faster you are, right? I mean, you have to be at the limit and have to be comfortable there. And I was not. I had a real hard time breaking my 33 or 35 years, no matter how you do the math, right? I got to take off my shoes a couple times, but I had a really hard time breaking my my training, my habits, my mindset, and embracing the concept of getting to the limit and being comfortable there. And so whenever I would get to the limit, I generally would spin, or you know, even worse. I mean, I hit the wall a few times. I hit the wall at Pitt. I hit the wall at Autobahn. I hit the wall at Mid-Ohio. So I tore up a lot of metal. I tore up a lot of race car, and learned how to fix it on my own, and/or with you know, some friends' help. And there it goes back to that. You know, you want to race in a spec series, right? Because couldn't carry all those parts with me. I had to put a whole new front end, right side front end on my Miata after coming over Madness too fast, looking in my mirrors instead of looking down the track. And so that's pretty ugly, right? You tear up the car and you have to put it back together. No fun. And then you have to kind of do that walk of shame through the paddock because everybody says, oh man, that sucks, right? But you know, it's just your day there. It's just your day in the spot, right? So yeah, pretty ugly stuff. Worst one was at Mid-Ohio, coming over the top of the wall, coming over the top of Madness. I lost it, spun down the hill, and wiped out the right side of the car. Mm. And when I hit the wall, you know, and I hit the tires, I was you become completely deflated, when you do this, right? When you wreck your car or when you run off the track and you bend it up a little bit, you lose all your self-confidence. And I don't know why, but it happens, right? It's just a giant letdown, at least for me, right? It's a giant learning moment, right? I mean, you really are so deflated, or at least I was, that you consider, like, is this really the hobby that I want to do? Like, is this really like the challenge that I want to put myself up to? And so I convinced, I did a little bit of self-reflection. I convinced myself that I wasn't going to let that wall be the wall. And I was going to work through it no matter what it took. And I did, I doubled down. What do you think I did? I wrecked again. probably shortly after that, I put the car in, off the track and did some more front end damage, nothing, or the rear end damage, right? Nothing is as dramatic as wiping out the right side. But I promised myself that I was going to get better at driving that car, or I was going to quit. And quitting is not really something I know how to do. And so that was really a defining moment in my driving. It was a defining moment as a student and in my personal life. It was like, hey, I don't really need to do this, but I'm gonna beat this. And I did. So I turned that ugly, right, which is the moral of the story, into a super big positive. Mm-hmm. And literally that year, I was awarded the HPDE Student of the Year at NASA Great Lakes because I didn't let the wall stop me.
Jennifer has that same idea, except her term was, and I'd do it again.
That's right. You talk to any of the veteran drivers, no matter what organization you're in, you ask them how many times or how many cars they tore up, and they go, recently or like in the beginning?
somebody said to us, actually, I guess when we lost one of the cars, and it made a lot of sense when he came to the team, was talking to us about it. He goes, it's not about if, it's about when.
Right.
So, and honestly, that's why we race in our series, the crap can series, because right. I can walk away from that car and not feel bad. I mean, yes, we'd have to build something, but it's not like I just spent like $10,000 just getting ready for that weekend, So
you just keep saying that.
Yeah, I know. I would feel different if I did it to the Miata, but but it's okay, because long as you're fine, the challenge is going to be every time we have to do this to another car again, we learn something more. And as long as we're constantly learning, it's okay.
So when any of my friends, my contemporaries, right, my tribe, like Bill and I talked about, right, has a racing incident, right, and there's an opportunity to say something to them at the right time, right, the two things I say to them are regroup and rebuild, or mm-hmm. rebuild and regroup, however you want to do it, but don't let this be the defining moment in this mm-hmm. in this chapter, because it's not a good way to end, mm-hmm. right? And unless that's the way you really want to throw your hands up, you've been doing it a long time, and maybe you're just tired of regrouping and rebuilding. But if there's a moral to the story is that you can be down, but you don't have to be out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, and you know what, that's really one of the lessons that I'm glad my boys get to see is, hey, look at all these guys that we see, or these girls that we see that come to the track and have a racing incident, right. Or have an incident on track. I you can bet your bottom dollar we'll see them maybe the next event or two events from now, mm-hmm. rebuilt, shiny, maybe not so shiny, but certainly track worthy. And out there getting it done, right? Enjoying the hobby. If it were easy, everybody would do it.
Right. Or nobody would do it.
If it were easy, everybody would do it.
That's right. So do you need a racing license or an HPD level to compete in the Trek series?
No, there's no license required, no competition license required. You just need to be in Great Lakes, HBDE Group 3 or higher, and that qualifies you to come on out and give it a try.
Mm-hmm. Even more reason to go to HBDE. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
No.
Right. So Bill and I are, while Bill is tilting the scale in his favor, I promised I'd use my thumb to help. So come on, girls, let's do it.
Come on, you can do it.
Yeah, that's right. So
I'll tell you this. I'll say this, ladies.
Yes.
And Bill, right? Once you do it, you'll be hooked.
The Trek series?
Yes.
Well, really?
Yep.
We already kind of do endurance as it is.
Right.
So I mean, we do the 2-day endurance. So
right. Mm-hmm. Right. So this will be a neat piece of cake.
It'll just be with our buds.
And you know what? It shouldn't be called Trek racing. It should be called buddy racing, because you are out there with your buds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a buddy racing series. It's, you know, you and your friends getting together and taking a really cool car around the track really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of fun. A good way to spend, a day or two at the track.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tim, you are a veteran listener. You have your sticker. You are indoctrinated. For some reason, you still listen to us. We appreciate that. Thank you very much. Your name's not even Fisher or Skripchuk. It's fantastic. You know what time it is.
Let's hear it.
Vicky. You got to get off of mute, though. Works so much better. No, really, you need to get off of mute.
I'm here.
There she goes.
Yeah.
She wasn't ready.
I wasn't ready. I got sidetracked. So
okay. We've been vibing to Tim for a while, so we're going to give him the abbreviated version.
Of?
Hit it. Fast and Furious story time questions.
Fast and Furious. All right.
Okay, Tim, what was your first car, and what's the worst car you've ever had?
Worst car I ever had was, hands down, a 1983 diesel Pontiac Grand Prix two-tone maroon with red velour interior.
Ooh, nice.
It was beautiful to look at, but hell to drive. It was GM's worst car ever. It was terrible. It would freeze. I grew up in the Northeast in New York, and it would freeze every winter. And the reason I got it is my dad bought it, and it stranded him so many times he gave it to me. I didn't even have to buy it off of him. He was just happy to give it to me.
Following up on that one, what is the car from your family that sticks out in your mind?
We had several cool cars. We had a Citroen with airbags, mm-hmm. and I don't think I ever saw it run.
So you really had one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really had one. I don't think it ever ran that I can remember, or at least that way. I think some of the coolest cars we had were. We had a big family. I come from a big family. So Country Squire station wagon with the rumble seats in the back that today would be, you know, completely illegal, and you'd be put in jail by Child Protective Services for putting your children at risk in the back seat like that, with the tailgate window all the way down, going up the New York State Thruway at I'm sure speeds that were ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite cars. And we had a Volkswagen, Volkswagen bus, but it had, you know, I don't even know how many windows it had, but it had more windows than a fishbowl. And it was that, I think that was my favorite.
That's awesome.
Between the Country Squire and the Volkswagen bus, those were pretty amazing cars.
So what is that car that got away?
I don't really have a car that ever got away. Everything that I've ever, and I hate to sound like this guy, but everything that I ever wanted, I got. And the one that I wanted and I never had was the 944. I went and scratched that itch.
Do you still want the 944?
I do. Oh. You know what? It's
you're still itching.
It's a gentleman's car. It's a gentleman's race car. And that's the best way I can describe it between a spec Miata and a 944, right? The spec Miata is going to spit, fart, burp, and fight you all the way around the track. 944 is a far more refined vehicle. And it's a gentleman's car, right? You put it where you want it, it stays right there and does everything you ask it to do, including mow the lawn.
And mows it quite well, I've seen.
Yeah, especially if you've seen pictures of me.
So who was your favorite race car driver or favorite race car driver growing up?
Mario Andretti.
He could do pretty well.
Mm-hmm. He still could do. Well, you know, I grew up in a big Irish-Italian family, and he was super good guy. And he was the class act, and I could identify because he looked like all my uncles.
He drove everything.
He did drive everything.
All right. So, Tim, we're going to start playing the lottery sometime. We're going to win. We're going to win big. We're going to have our desert island. All guests are welcome. I need to know what your five cars are you want on our desert island that has a track.
All right. DeLorean, because it looks cool.
Okay.
Doesn't drive worth anything, but it looks cool. Lotus Elise.
Oh,
I really like that. I really like that car. Super, super good looking car, easy to work on. Basic motor, and it just all around sexy car.
You want one thing that no one knows about me?
Let's hear it.
My first job out of college was making the composite brake rotors for the Lotus Elise.
There you go. That's cool. That's a cool fact. Yeah. Fun fact, right?
Don't blame me if they don't. That's work. Cool.
Yeah. So that's two. We got three to go.
Yeah.
Party bus.
Oh wow. Jennifer, your taco truck's got friends now.
All right.
Yeah. No, party bus, because what good is having a gaggle of cars if you can't enjoy it with your friends, right?
Yep. I mean, right.
If you can't enjoy going around and hey, let's go check out the cars, then really, you know, what's the sense of having them? Mm-hmm. And I mean a big party bus.
No joke party bus.
I'm not talking Greyhound, but I'm talking like 30 people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No worries.
Toyota 4x4.
Okay. For the off-road track?
Yeah, for the off-road track, because okay. That's super cool. And then whatever car my wife asked me to bring.
Oh, very nicely done. Mm-hmm. We got to get her out racing. You just
You get her to the track. She puts up with all my crap, so I'm sure she'd get some crappy car, but it'd be hers.
You get her to the track. We'll take care of the rest for you. That's our job.
We're nice people.
You guys are great. I really enjoy seeing you guys at the track.
Well, we can warm her up.
Yeah.
So let me see. What car would you love to switch into that you're currently racing against or have in the past? And at what racetrack?
Hands down, easy, quick answer, Thunder Roadster.
Okay.
What track?
What track? Probably NCM.
Oof, that'd be fun.
Yeah. Now a few of my friends have transitioned to that car. Mm-hmm. And the smiles on their face makes me a little jealous.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
All right, so let me ask, do you name your cars?
No, not necessarily. I call them names.
Some are nice. I do too ones. Sometimes.
Some are not so but nice ones. I don't
necessarily
ones.
Name them.
Alrighty. Classic race driver question. What is the fastest you've ever driven a car? What car and where and when? And if needed, Mexico seems to be a very popular place.
No, you know, New York State Thruway is my answer.
Oh, that is a very easy place to go fast.
More than 7 years ago.
Oh, very nice.
was a buddy of mine's Z28, kind of a drag car, but was more of a street racer car. And we took it up the New York State Thruway at about 145 miles an hour.
Wow.
And that was the absolute scariest time I've ever been in a car, because up until that point, and it was in a straight line, so it really doesn't count. Mm-hmm. Road racing, probably about maybe 135 on a Super Sunday.
Nice.
Yeah. In fact, it was on Mid Ohio.
Back straight.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
In a super, really nice Supra in like that dark blue. It was great. When we do that Super Sunday deal, we're lucky enough to show the customers kind of what the car can do a little bit. And I got the customer's permission to really open it up on the track. And I was quite surprised on that back track, 130, that back straight 135.
With more probably in there. Just, it's not your
car. Oh, there definitely was. That was not all she had. That's for sure.
So, Tim, what's your favorite track so far? And do you have a favorite turn so far?
Yeah. So, favorite turn is the sinkhole at NCM.
Okay.
And here's the reason.
I was going to say that's new one for everybody.
Yeah. And here's the reason. It's the first time that I ever felt my car rotating.
Ah.
And the feeling was so cool that it's stuck in my head. So I really enjoy that series of turns as you come through the sinkhole. It's a continuous climbing up a hill kind of a turn that you accelerate in and slide out of on the way out. And it's super cool. It's super cool. Okay. Next question.
Miss Vicky, your last one.
Let me see. What is your, here we go. Where would your ultimate road trip be from and to, and in what car?
I've done a bunch of road tripping in my life, so I can tell you
Z28.
Boring Hyundai Elantra. Ooh. Kind of thing.
My apologies.
So let's talk, I guess, the place that I probably want to road trip the most right now is to the Dragon's Tail.
Okay.
And I would do it in any of my cars or my kids' cars with my kids.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. Miss Jen, you going to choose your favorite one?
Sure. So what is your favorite car movie or car from a movie of all time?
Easy. Mustang from Bullet. Steve McQueen's God.
Oh, okay.
Well, we can't say that's the first time we've heard that one, Tim. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, of course not. That's because the cool factor is amazing. Mm-hmm.
I'm still waiting for a Munsters car, but haven't had one yet. But that's okay. That's okay.
Very good.
Well, Tim, thank you for putting up with us. We will definitely have to have you on again. We had a whole nother section or two of stuff we didn't even get to, and we've already put you into overtime, but we do appreciate your tolerance of our long podcast, and thank you for everything you've done, and it's been great to be racing with you, and you're definitely part of the tribe, and we love getting out to the track and seeing you and your family.
Can't wait to see you guys next time. Really looking forward to it. And thanks for the invite, guys. It was a special time. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Great.
No worries. Will we be seeing you at ACC or?
Yes, you will. I'm kind of a track rat now. So
you're a track hoe.
Master. Yeah, I was keeping it clean.
You're aspiring. And
you know what? My wife would absolutely agree with you.
So you're aspiring to Bill Griffin status?
You know, probably. You know, if I could, I'm not far behind. I shave, but I don't have a beard. But if I had it, it would partially be white.
Oh.
So, you know, Bill Griffin's got that great, great.
He does.
Father time look. You know.
That's right.
And
he's at the track as much as everybody else wishes they were. So.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, but. You know, someday I've got a few more years before they kick me out of my gig here at the company. So I can't really do it as much as I want, but I get there as often as I can.
Yeah. I don't know that there is such a thing as every time that I want, but yes, it's something to get to.
Right. Sir, there's the retirement gig, right? Get an RV and drag your race car to all the tracks you want to do. You know?
Exactly. There's so many. What's your favorite racetrack? The next one. So
yeah, right, the one I'm about to get on.
Exactly. Well, thank you, sir. You have a great night, and great coming and talking to you.
Yep, thank you guys. I really appreciate it. We'll see everybody at Autobahn.
That would be great.
All right, bye.
All right, Tim, thank you for coming on. Sorry for
my pleasure.
Sorry for the pain you're about to endure, but you know, it is
what it is. You know, I agreed to it, so here we go.
Yeah. yet again, another proof, race car drivers make poor decisions.